The reason the CIA and their allies in the Pentagon and elsewhere were prepared to risk Wilson's fury was because they were counting on the voters of the 2nd Congressional District to rid them of this meddlesome politician. Given the accumulated scandals, it seemed inconceivable that his constituents would return such a persistent sinner to office. But in the final days of the Wilson campaign, something noticeable began to happen. It had to do with an atmosphere around him. Anyone who studies television knows that it is less important what a person says on TV than how he projects himself. Afghanistan wasn't an issue in the campaign, but something about the way Charlie felt about the cause of Afghanistan and his mission there burned so brightly inside him that it made him look as if he had been born again. He may not have found God, but Charlie Wilson's constituents could see that his needle was once again pointing north. On primary night, everyone who counted in Charlie's life gathered at his house on Crooked Creek, his mother and sister, staffers and friends. Charles Fawcett and Joanne added a touch of glamour by driving in from River Oaks in an exotic recreational vehicle that had been a gift to Fawcett from the King of Morocco. The house was full of friends, but there was among them all a sense that this might be Charlie's Waterloo, particularly when disastrous early returns from Nacogdoches came in. Jerry Johnson, the Sunday school teacher, had swept the county. A concerned Charlie Fawcett took Wilson aside to try to cheer him up. "That doesn't mean a thing, Charlie. You can be far more effective for the Mujahideen out of Congress than in." Wilson was horrified by this well-meaning pep talk. The fact was that he would be utterly useless to the Mujahideen if he lost. In fact, he didn't really know what value he could be to anyone. Arthur Temple, the timber baron who had been Charlie's political patron since he'd first gone into politics, sat Buddha-like and disapproving as he watched the election reports. Temple was a kind of surrogate father to Charlie, an influential businessman and progressive reformer who had once believed that Charlie could go all the way to the top. Even Charlie's mother looked concerned. She had been by his side ever since he first ran for office, campaigning at teas and going door to door like the Kennedy women. What was there to say to her now except that he had brought this ruin down upon himself? Finding it too trying to put on a brave face, Charlie asked Joanne to come with him into the bedroom. "He told me things didn't look good," she remembered. "I just told him he was wonderful. He was a real hero to me." When all seemed lost, the tide began slowly to turn. By the end of the night, the tally stood at 55% for Wilson, 45% divided between the four others. Miraculously, at his lowest moment, Charlie had found his moorings. He hadn't told his born-again constituents that he wanted their vote so that he could save the Afghans, or even because he wanted to do in the evil empire. He hadn't had to. Whatever it was about him, they liked what they saw. He was there to stay, with all his seniority and unsettling allies. And when he returned to the capital 2 days later, all his pent-up energy was turned on Langley. At this very moment, Gustav Rakatos's fortunes were also shifting. He had managed to win himself a powerful new patron. Ed Ginowitz was Claire George's number two man, the associate deputy director for operations. Like Gust, Ginowitz was not part of the agency's old boy elite. He was a second-generation American whose father had been born in Poland. A former Marine, he had spent most of his first 20 years at the CIA in the Soviet division. Ginowitz was a dyed-in-the-wool communist hater, and by 1984 he was the second most important man in the clandestine services. Day in, day out, his primary responsibility was selecting officers for the division's key assignments. But when Claire George was out of town, he served as deputy director for operations. He could be a powerful friend, and his thinking ran very differently from that of Chuck Cogan and the rest of the 7th floor. Ginowitz didn't like the idea of a wasting action in Afghanistan. No doubt because of his own family history, he responded personally to the plight of people enslaved by communism. He had been to the Mujahideen training camps near the Afghan border, had sat with the elders, and watched shoeless young boys preparing to go fight the Red Army. His response was understandably moralistic, from a man whose father's homeland was behind the Iron Curtain. "How in Christ's name could you send these guys into battle and say, 'You don't have much of a chance, but do your best'? That is despicable." Ginowitz had watched Avrakatos take command of the Afghan account with growing admiration and then cheerleading. Gust was only the acting chief, but he was playing as if he were there for the long haul. While Wilson had appeared to be going down and out in East Texas, the Soviets had gone on the attack. There were scenes that spring in Afghanistan of military striking power not witnessed in the world since Vietnam. Great clouds of dust rose as the 40th Army marched 20,000 troops into the Panjshir Valley to finish off Massoud once and for all. Unlike earlier campaigns, these Soviet troops were highly trained and motivated. They rode into battle in tanks and armored personnel carriers, with MiGs and helicopter gunships overhead providing close air support. Any previous distinction that the Soviet command might have made between the Mujahideen and the civilian population that provided assistance of any kind suddenly disappeared as silver-bodied Tu-16s operating from bases in the Soviet Union began carpet bombing even primitive mud-walled villages where the Mujahideen might have received support. At Langley, Avrakatos was not surprised. He had been waiting for the escalation, knowing that the agency had been egging it on. As he saw it, the Soviets had no choice. Given their mentality, they couldn't let a bunch of ragheads openly defy them. The 40th Army was now moving to crush the resistance, and Avrakatos took the position they might just succeed if the agency didn't start playing tough. It was precisely because of Avrakatos's killer approach to the job that Genowitz became his advocate. He had become angry at the way the war was being run. "The PACs were in charge of everything, running the whole show, and I said, 'That's bullshit. We want to help plan battles, want to look at the kind of training they're getting.'" So Genowitz went to the director and said that Afghanistan was going nowhere and that the agency had to get tougher. According to him, the director said, "Go ahead, make your call, you're in charge." That simple statement of Casey's is the kind of murky opening that men like Genowitz and Avrakatos are wont to take advantage of. One day, when Claire George was out of the country and Genowitz was the acting chief, Avrakatos burst into the ADDO's office with a challenge. "It's been almost a year that I've been helping McGaffin as acting chief, and the rule is that if you have the job for 3 months and you want it, you get it. I want it. Unless you want another fucker in here who just follows orders." Genowitz was not the kind of man who was ruffled by such a presentation. "You're right," he responded. "I'm going to do it. I shouldn't, but Claire's gone." Chuck Cogan was reportedly appalled and tried to challenge the appointment. According to Avrakatos, Genowitz silenced Cogan with a communique of unusual clarity. "Higher authority wants a mean fucker in the job." Genowitz had the technical authority to make this appointment, but given Avrakatos' intensely complicated history with Claire George, it had required some guts. Now, unless George was prepared to overrule his deputy, it was a fait accompli. Recalling that moment, Genowitz observed that his boss was furious but somehow compromised in his ability to challenge the appointment. Claire had a secret admiration for Gust from their time together in Athens. People didn't understand the depth of their relationship, but it was one of those love-hate relationships. He says the two had had a falling out over something that no one fully understood. "In my own heart, I always felt Gust had something on Claire, something he knew about Claire himself or about the family. Claire didn't like that. Gust would never betray a trust or confidence, but Claire couldn't stand it." According to one account, George spent the better part of 15 minutes shouting at Genowitz until the deputy said that he had already spoken to Casey and McMahon about Gust, and they thought his appointment was a good idea. Perhaps George should check with them, he said, knowing that was about the last thing George would want to do. In the end, the DDO chose not to overturn the decision, and instead congratulated Gust, saying that he was happy to have been able to do it for him. Avrakatos, who knew exactly what George had been doing, played along. Why not? He now had the job. Part of the pleasure of that circumstance involved watching his rival, Alan Fears, slowly self-destructing. Denied Afghanistan, Fears would end up in charge of the Contra War, which would soon be outlawed by Congress. He would play a role on the fringes of the Iran-Contra Arms for Hostages scheme. Finally, it would be his fate to become the clandestine service's first Judas. Faced with near-certain imprisonment for lying to Congress about the Iran-Contra affair, Fears would take the special prosecutor's offer of immunity if he told all. In a courtroom filled with former brothers of the clandestine service, a weeping Alan Fears would give the testimony that would doom his old chief, Claire George. Genowitz would later look back on his act of bureaucratic daring and say that pushing fears aside and gambling on Avrakatos might well have been his most prescient decision in a long CIA career. By the time Avrakatos had maneuvered himself into his new post, Charlie Wilson and the CIA were in a virtual state of war. What would soon become clear to Avrakatos is that Wilson had the will and the ability to win. That first came into focus at Langley when Wilson drew on his real strength, the power to punish. He called Jim Van Wagenen, the Defense Appropriations staffer responsible for black programs, and asked, "What are the CIA's crown jewels?" Recognizing the veiled threat in the question, Van Wagenen sprang into action, informing John McMahon that Wilson was going to go after the agency's pet programs if they didn't back off. The staffer made it clear that Wilson enjoyed the support of the full subcommittee on this one, and that the agency was now on the verge of alienating those very legislators on whom they relied for money. Wilson even managed to make the CIA believe he would go after Crown Jewel No. 1, the Contra War in Nicaragua. "I'm sure I implied that I might go over to the other side on the Contras," admits Wilson somewhat sheepishly, because it would have been a bold defection from the anti-communist camp. "But at that point I was willing to do anything I could to embarrass them. I probably threatened them well beyond what I could have done, but I always try to make people think I'm a little crazy." This, of course, is the madman theory of how power is best exercised, the notion that a reputation for unpredictability and excessive use of force makes threats more effective. It's worth noting that Wilson was making these rumblings at a time when the Democratic majority in the House had already mobilized against the CIA because of Nicaragua. Had the hawkish Wilson taken his conservative following and made common cause with the opposition, it might well have been a rout for the agency. In retrospect, Wilson acknowledges that this debate over the Oerlikon, a weapon that ultimately proved to be of marginal value, was really not about the weapon itself. It was about his personal march under the aegis of the U.S. Congress onto the seventh floor of Langley to force the agency into a bigger war than it wanted to fight. As he sees it now, this bureaucratic battle in 1984 was the defining moment of the Afghan War. Every other tactical decision to escalate, including the introduction of the American Stingers 2 years later, followed from it. "They were offended to the point of despair, and they weren't going to let it happen," remembers Wilson. "But I knew there was no point to this war if you couldn't shoot down the helicopters. They wanted to fight to the last Afghan and not expose the United States to any risk at all. But I didn't have any interest in killing a million Afghans to cause the Russians some mild embarrassment, and it still absolutely enrages me to think of it."